Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have, as our guest in this first hour of Focus, Gary Allen Fine. He's a professor of sociology at Northwestern University. He's interested in a number of things, but among other things, he is an authority on rumor, folklore, and urban legend. And he's been studying rumors for a long time, more than 35 years. And he began by taking a look at the ways that rumors affect race relations and make it difficult sometimes for black people and white people to get together. In some of his more recent work, he's looked at rumors that deal with international politics. And he has written about that in a book that he has co-authored. The title of the book is The Global Grapevine, Why Rumors of Terrorism, Immigration, and Trade Matter. This book is published by the Oxford University Press, and it is co-authored with Bill Ellis, who is an emeritus professor of English and American Studies at Penn State. Professor Fine is here visiting the campus. He gave a talk yesterday, and we're really pleased that he could spend a little bit of time with us talking about rumors, something that he says provides access to what people really believe and to beliefs that they keep hidden. So that's on the agenda here for this first part of the show. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send in a question or a comment by email if you'd like to do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you have questions, you can join in the conversation. Thank you very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
I know we were just chatting here a little bit about the wide range of your interests, including the subject of rumors and reputation. And you're working on a book about competitive chess, and you have done some writing about figures in American history that are complicated and controversial and how it is we think about them. People like Joe McCarthy and Charles Lindbergh and Benedict Arnold. So this is a pretty wide range of interest. Let me just ask you about rumors and how it is that you became interested in that as a research topic.
Well, I became interested in the study of rumors probably about 35, maybe almost 40 years ago when I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I was interested in how information was spread in a social system, in a community. And one of those aspects has to do with gossip and rumor, somewhat different concepts but overlapping concepts, and how people come to believe that certain claims about the world are accurate or inaccurate.
This, I guess the basic idea here is that if you look at rumors and maybe you even put aside the effort to determine whether something is true or not, that, mm-hmm. that may indeed be a separate set of questions, that what it does, it really tells you what people worry about, what they're afraid of, and maybe it gives people a way of talking about those things in a way that allows it to put some distance between themselves and whatever it is that they're talking about.
Right. I mean, the great power of rumor and its great consequence is the fact that people can talk about those things that they believe, those things they find plausible, but they do it in such a way by saying, this actually happened, as opposed to saying, I believe, you know, I feel this way about black people or about foreigners or immigrants. They don't have to make those general claims. They can say, did you hear last weekend there was this shooting or that there was this drug running? You know, they can say, I'm talking about facts. I'm not talking about opinions, even if the facts prove not to be accurate.
Well, how I know that you have looked at what it is that about a particular rumor that some one person might look at it and think that it was wildly outrageous. Mm-hmm. They would listen to the story and they would say something like, well, that couldn't possibly happen. So why is it that one person would say, no way that could happen, but somebody else would say, no, actually, I believe that in fact could happen?
Well, we talk about the politics of plausibility and the politics of credibility. Mm-hmm. Politics of plausibility is from where we sit us as individuals and as members of groups. We believe, we trust that the world is a particular way. And if we hear a claim that is in accord with what we believe about the world, we are likely to accept it. Politics of credibility has to do with who we hear it from. So that there are some people that we hear information from and we say, I believe it by virtue of this person's position or this person's past, you know, what they've told us previously. Mm-hmm. So those two things together, plausibility and credibility, contribute to whether we are likely to believe a claim that others with different sets of plausibility and credibility find crazy, outrageous, silly, dangerous.
Yeah. And so it's a combination of trusted source and previous experience.
Yes, that's right. Trusted source and the experience that we have living in the world as we believe that we know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk some more about what the functions of these things are. And I suppose maybe another question would be, maybe it's a slightly different question, but why it is we so much enjoy spreading them?
Well, I think we enjoy spreading rumor and gossip for a number of different reasons. First, the content is entertaining. It's juicy. You know, it's talking about some scandal or some wild belief, and you know, people pay attention to that the same way that they will watch a drama show on television or movie or whatever. So that there's that component to it. The other thing is that it makes us feel that we're in the know, that we control our world because we understand it. And we may be wrong, we often are, but at least we have that confidence of believing these things. And so you can see this in terms of political rumors, you know, the rumors about particular candidates, you know, are spread in particular political communities. So that you hear, you know, if you are opposed to Obama, you'll hear a certain set of rumors. If you're opposed to Romney, perhaps other rumors. You know, it fits with our belief in reality. It's what we say. We say that there are some claims that are too good to be false, right? That they just make so much sense that we don't want to look at them too closely because we know in our hearts that they must be true.
How much of that may also be related to its entertainment value? That is something is such a good story in that sense that seems to enhance its value, or maybe it enhances its plausibility.
Well, those juicy stories, you know, are the ones that we tend to be drawn to as long as they are seen as plausible. So, you know, there are any number of political stories that get spread. Some of them have legs, some of them that you hear a lot about, and others that disappear.
It seems that it's common that the subject of the rumor, the person or persons that it's about, are what I guess in sociological terms you would call others. That is, people who are not, you know, we have a sense of who our group is, this group that we belong to. And it seems that an awful lot of rumors are about, it's about somebody else. It's about a group that's different, and possibly a group that we are worried about, feel threatened by, troubled by, and in fact might not have a lot of real personal experience about. How much of rumor has some function of binding the members of a particular group together and help them to define who they are as opposed to this other that we say, well, this is what we are, but we're not that?
Well, when we talk about boundaries, it contributes to what we are likely to find as plausible. And so if there's a group that we don't know very much about or that seems strange, we have stereotypes about that group, but we also are more likely to we were less likely to be able to define what is likely, what is plausible. We're more likely to accept wild stories. And often in doing this, we set up these categories of, you know, President Obama is a Muslim. You know, so we buy into this idea of our image of the president and our image of Muslims. And if we're, you know, not supporters of the president and not Muslim ourselves, then, you know, we have created this gap, this boundary between us and them.
Well, how is it? It's in a particular case, say a case like that, that people will hold on to a particular belief in the face of some what somebody else would say was convincing evidence that it was not true.
Well, I like the way you put it, because it's someone else is saying this is convincing evidence, and. Yeah, it may be that there are groups with authority who look into things, members of the press, for example, and they say, oh, this is crazy, this is very unlikely. And yet for others, you know, they have different criteria, and they say, no, I think it's plausible. The thing that I've argued is facts are promiscuous. There are so many facts out there, or so many claims, if not facts, that you can pick and choose, and you can create your own social world based on that information. And you can see that in these political rumors. You know, there's enough that allows you to say, well, if you want to believe that the president is Muslim, you can say, well, his father was Muslim. You can say his stepfather was Muslim. Well, doesn't that make sense? Or that the church he belonged to had connections or seemed like the black Muslim, you know, and therefore you have this body of information that if you choose, you can say this is enough information for me to make that claim. Now, others can look at that the same body of information, and they can say, no, you know, the president claims to be a Christian. He went to church, a Christian church, and therefore we don't find that plausible. It's a battle between groups and between belief sets.
Let me just reintroduce our guest very quickly here. We're talking with Gary Allen Fine. He is professor of sociology at Northwestern University. He's visiting the campus, gave a talk, and was good enough to come spend some time with us here this morning to talk about one of the things that he is particularly interested in, rumor, folklore, urban legend. That's always been an interest of his, or has been for quite a few years, and has done a lot of writing on the subject, including a recent book, which is entitled The Global Grapevine. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Has been out now for a couple of years. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And here is someone to join in the conversation. We'll bring him in right now in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two things, if I may. One is, this isn't asked in malice, but I think I might accuse you of being, in the interest of being even-handed and balanced, of distorting things by that virtue. I mean, objectivity is what you strive for, and yet, if objectively speaking, one side is much more prevalent to using and more preponderant in using propaganda, i.e. the Republicans, then to be even-handed to their distortions of reality, i.e. like the President of the United States is a socialist, even-handedness and objectivity are at the odds there, I think. And then the second thing is, I wonder if you'd address, like, the whole propaganda issue is, like, how that distorts reality, and if you like, how that relates to rumor. And you talked about politics and being involved with this sort of thing, and I'll just stand and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. A very interesting comment. You know, the problem with a comment like that is that it sort of takes our side as being the objective side. So in the case of this caller and many listeners, I'm sure, you know, it's the Republicans that are using propaganda and the Democrats are telling us the truth. But if you go into other communities, it gets flipped. So, you know, it becomes difficult. Now, it's not I mean, the caller is correct to say that there is what we would say an obdurate reality. There's a reality out there. The difficulty is, how do we get to that reality when we're not directly a part of it? So who are we going to trust? Are we going to trust Fox News, or is it going to be MSNBC? How are we going to distinguish? Now, each individual is able to do that and is able to do it in a way that is fairly comfortable. I was asked to give a keynote speech at a conference in Washington, D.C. on uncertain knowledge. And they asked me to talk about rumors about President Obama. And one of the rumors that I talked about was this claim that the president is a socialist. You hear this a lot. And the caller mentioned it as well. What does it mean to say that someone is, quote, a socialist? Well, it all depends. If you mean that President Obama wants to control the means of production in good Marxist fashion, then most of us, even most Republicans, would say, no, he's not a socialist in that sense. If we mean that by socialist someone who wants to increase the size of government, then in that sense, well, he does want to increase the size of government. If we mean it's simply being a bad guy, like being a fascist, if Republicans are often attacked as being fascist, Democrats as being socialist or communist, well, in that case, it depends, in whose chair you sit.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the caller also used the word propaganda. And I suppose that one might say that propaganda is, institutionalized rumor. I don't know how you would define it. Do you see there being some connection between propaganda and rumor?
Well, propaganda is the truth claims that people we don't like make. And truth is what we say. So it's I think to go a little bit beyond that is propaganda implies that people are making claims deliberately, and often the implication is falsely, things that they know better. And so I was talking yesterday about Southern segregationist senators and governors and how they made the transition from being segregationists in the 1950s, early 60s, to being non-segregationists in the 1970s, opposing segregation. I used the case of George Wallace and Strom Thurmond. And, the point that I was making is that politicians try to align themselves with their publics. And so what claims they make is a function of the claims, the wide claims within the social system that they're a part of. And so looking at George Wallace, for example, who begins as the face of American segregation. But by 1986, he is more popular among African American voters than he is among white voters in the state of Alabama. And it reminds us that these are fluid systems, and fluid, the beliefs can be fluid, and the presentation of them can be.
All right, very interesting. We have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Pontiac, line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Hi. I'm a quilt maker and a historian. And years ago, someone came out with a book claiming to help escaped slaves, cross through and get to safety by using marks on quilts and quilts hung. And there was never any credible evidence of this. It was somebody's story passed on. Have you come across any information on that?
Well, I certainly heard that claim and know of the book.
Yes.
And I think you're right to say that there certainly hasn't been definitive information that this is widespread.
First of all, many of the quilt patterns at that time had different names in different regions. Many of the quilts talked about in the book, those patterns didn't even develop until after the Civil War. And yet, It's mm-hmm. it went around, taught in schools. The kids do programs on it. It's become more of a myth. And as a historian myself, I'm okay with it as a myth. I'm not okay with it as a factual thing without evidence, which I've never seen.
Right. It's a feel-good story.
Yes.
You know, we believe it is a good thing for African Americans to escape from slavery. This is a story about how they did it. You know, makes kids feel good. It's, you know, just one of these feel good stories. Is it true? Well, one of the things about truth, there may have been an instance in which a quilt was used
sure.
in this way, but whether it was a general process, I think you're. My understanding is that you're right, that there's not a lot of evidence.
No, but it's difficult because as a historian, we're trying to create, when we look back in history, we're trying to get a sense of what really happened in the world. And, you know, I mean, it's very hard to fight stuff like that once it gets out and becomes, you know, the truth or the new thing. And I think the other thing you could talk about maybe would be of interest to people would be information on vaccines and all, you know, different types of autism
yes.
that supposedly that creates. And that seems to have been pretty well debunked by some actual definitive studies. And, I mean, isn't there a place where eventually there is a reality and there is something that is more of a myth? And
mm-hmm.
it's not all just this is my reality and this is your reality, but I don't know how you get – I mean, people aren't going to change either.
Right. I mean, there's a saying, a wise saying, that everyone is entitled to their opinion.
Right.
They're not entitled to their facts.
Right, right.
Of course, it becomes difficult to determine, you know, who gets to choose which are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the problem. And the literature on vaccines, which I've written about in my book that deals with racial rumors, Whispers on the Color Line, it talks about the belief in African American communities, very powerful belief, and an understandable belief in some ways, that the vaccines that black children receive cause them harm, are deliberately designed to cause them harm. And, you know, one, you know, remembering the Tuskegee syphilis
right.
study and the various other uses of black bodies by medical researchers, one can understand where that comes from. On the other hand, it puts a lot of African American children at risk if they're not getting their, you know, measles vaccine or the polio vaccines or, you know, other forms of vaccines that most of us believe are healthy. Helpful. Now, of course, there are instances in which vaccines cause problems and there are negative side effects. You know, the autism vaccine is a case in point that there are, you know, children who receive particular vaccines and then subsequently are diagnosed with autism. And so parents can say, how did this come about? Well, it was 2 weeks before that my daughter received this vaccine, and now she's diagnosed. You make this cause and effect connection in your particular case. You can understand how that comes about.
Uh-huh.
Even though when we do larger studies, we, you know, it is now assumed by many people, many scientists, that there is no direct effect.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. How to just I have some other people I get on right onto in a moment, but it strikes me when you look at over time the things that people have worried about, and so the things that they have talked about, cases like this, that it frequently comes down to fears about contagion, contamination, foreigners, oppressive government power. Are those themes that you can trace back for a very long way?
We actually can trace some rumors back to the Roman Empire. And they are rumors that are recognizably similar and rumors that deal with contamination, particularly food contamination or contamination of water and wells. And so we will often still hear, you know, fears about some group that we dislike, some, let's say, terrorist group planning to poison reservoirs. And it's the same tradition. Now, you know, you have sometimes rumors have the effect of causing people to act them out. So I don't want to say that we don't need to watch over our reservoirs in certain cases, but the rumors play into this idea of contamination.
We're talking this morning, this hour, with Gary Allen Fine. He's a professor of sociology at Northwestern University and has been writing and doing research for some time now on rumor, folklore, urban legend, just a few of the things that he's interested in. He's visiting here the campus. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop for unique gift ideas. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com or 217-333-6280.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different topics for you across the week, Monday through Friday, 10 until noon. Let me just mention that on Monday, in the first hour, our guest is Robert Switzer. He's an emeritus professor of biochemistry at University of Illinois, and we will be talking about a book that he's authored that's a memoir of some of his experiences growing up on a family farm. It was a dairy farm, and it was something that went back to, I believe, to his grandparents. And so it's in part about that, but it's also about a way of life that's really vanishing in this country. We'll talk about that Monday at 10. And then in the second hour, our guest is Dame Daphne Sheldrick. She is quite well known as a conservationist in Africa. She was born in Kenya, and for many years she worked alongside her husband, who was the founder and warden of the Tsavo National Park, and has done a lot of work in trying to protect the animals that live in that park, and elephants in particular. And so she's written a memoir that's titled Love, Life, and Elephants, an African Love Story, and she'll talk with us Monday. You can find out what we'll do for the rest of the week by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media, and you can check us out on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Gary Allen Fine. He's professor of sociology at Northwestern University. He's visiting the campus, gave a talk yesterday, and is talking with us about one of the things that he's interested in, and that is rumor. Rumor, folklore, urban legend. He first wrote about this in a book that was titled Whispers on the Color Line, which was about rumors and things that were said in black and white communities about the other community. And then most recently, he's written a book that's titled Global Grapevine. The Global Grapevine is published by the Oxford University Press. And that looks at global politics, looks at rumors concerning things like terrorism, immigration, and so forth. And questions, again, are welcome. We have somebody here who's been patient. We'll get right to them. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This is line number two in Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Yes.
2 points. Your first is the use of the term socialist, claiming that Barack Obama is a socialist, and that you say that, yes, you could say this if you mean that he wants a larger government, which has never been a term, has never been a definition of socialist. There's a quite well-defined and accepted set of ends that have always been attributed to socialism, and big government of itself is hardly sufficient to call someone a socialist. Actually, what you have here is not two legitimate accepted definitions of a term, but a switching of meaning, and a very deliberate one, because the person who's doing it knows that the average citizen will take the first meaning of socialist, and when you use the second meaning, and claim someone as a socialist, you know that they are going to assume you mean the traditional meaning. This changing of meanings, of definitions, is quite common. Both parties have done it. The Democrats in the past have claimed the Republicans of the 50s, 60s, even 70s were conservatives, when by any rational examination of the facts, they were traditional liberals. And actually, the Democrats have had to pay for that now. But anyway, it's a very pernicious tactic, and it is not to be legitimatized the way you seem to be. Another point of it is the switching of the meaning of liberal itself, where it's been the attempt has been made to make that a synonym for socialist. Another problem is that there are different sets of facts and that somehow they're equivalent. And here the global warming question is the one that comes to mind first. There is a body of fact which is accepted by probably 95% of climatologists and other expert opinions in the field, and there is about 5% of men in the field, men and women, mostly employed by the energy industry, which would dispute this. And then there is a very large body of uninformed opinion. Now, for news media, supposedly objective, to take this as equivalent fact is, to my mind, rather reprehensible. Would you care to comment?
Well, you raise a number of quite interesting points. With regard to the question of terms like socialist, conservative, there are historical meanings of terms. I'm as I was listening to you, I was thinking back to my youth and the rather common use of the term fascist. You know, fascist became a term of abuse of people who were generally on the right, but people who were disliked. It didn't have anything to do with historical fascism, you know, Mussolini and the theory of fascism. And, you know, I think that the point that you're making about socialism not having to do with, you know, whether we call it Marxist socialist, Marxist-Leninist, is certainly accurate. But terms come to be unmoored. They come to have meaning in political discourse, even if those meanings are not historically accurate meanings. So I think in that case, that's an important point to make. And I certainly don't argue that everything is up for grabs, that there are obdurate realities and there are misuses of terms, just as some of us at a younger age misused the term fascism. Some people today, many people today, will misuse the term socialism. You know, with regard to scientific debates and public policy debates, again, there are realities there. But as the caller was talking about the global warming issue, he was raising this question of consensus. So the argument was, well, 95% of people believe this and 5% believe that. Well, that the danger in that is that you decide scientific issues by a plebiscite, by a vote. You know, more people on one side, fewer people on the other. It may well be, and I prepare to believe entirely that there is man-made global warming. I'm not arguing against that. But you also see this debate going on between global warming deniers, as they are called by their opponents, and the other side, who are called earthers, like birthers. So, you know, and they're the people who believe in global warming, even though from that point of view they shouldn't. So you have the deniers versus the earthers, and each side is making their own reputational claims.
I have somebody else here I want to get onto in just a moment. And again, we're moving into about our last 15 minutes here with our guest, by the way. I'll introduce again Gary Allen Fine. He's a professor of sociology at Northwestern University, someone who is interested in rumor. And that's just one of the things that he's written about. Just I'm going back to thinking about the concerns that terrorists are going to poison the water supply, and about you're saying that, in fact, people have been worried about terrorists poisoning water supply for a couple thousand years now.
Right.
Given that some of the themes here are pretty durable, one thing that does seem to be different now is we have new and improved mechanisms for spreading rumor. Allows rumors, I think, perhaps to spread more quickly and more widely than in the past. Does that really change anything in any way other than it does, in fact, facilitate the spreading of rumors?
It intensifies rumors. And what you see is a rapid spread of rumors and a rapid decline in some cases, because the social media, the internet, allows denials to get out much quicker. Mm-hmm. So in the past, you would see a slow buildup of rumors spread from community to community to community, and then a slow demise of that belief. Today, it's much more of a spike.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We'll talk next with somebody in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I want to just probe your definition of propaganda a little bit. It seems to me a little bit unhelpful and a little bit in contradiction to the other things that you're saying, in the sense that if we simply take propaganda as sort of what the other side says, it seems that we're not really looking at a whole process that creates propaganda, as opposed to some kind of information that's a little more nuanced, connected with fact and so forth. And as David Inge mentioned before, given the rate at which information, rumors, whatever can be produced in the present age, it seems that someone who's dealing with this as their main area of inquiry should be encouraging people to probe a little deeper beyond what they see, beyond the propaganda, and develop a process for differentiating between something that's completely manufactured, such as the notion that President Obama is a Muslim, as opposed to something which may be able to be contested in terms of describing him as a liberal or a socialist and so forth. So I think that as we get more and more information, we find that the skills that we have and the capacity that we have to analyze this information, also becomes more complex. So I think you might want to look at that definition of propaganda and whether that really kind of empowers people to look beyond the surface of propaganda to a more analytical way of taking that apart.
Well, you have a comment on that?
Yes. I mean, as a sociologist, I absolutely agree that we have to look at the sources of the information that we receive. To what extent, the caller talked about this particular claim about Obama being a Muslim as being completely manufactured. And there are claims that are manufactured by organizations, by groups, intentionally manufactured. Now, I'm not sure that particular claim was one that was manufactured by an organization as opposed to bubbling up from people who mistrusted the president. But certainly the general point is an accurate one. It is important for us, whenever we receive information, whether it is from people, quote, on our side or people we oppose, to ask, where did that information come from? Who created that statistic? Who created that piece of knowledge? Where did they learn it from? That's the challenge in terms of understanding rumor and thus also understanding propaganda.
And that's something, it just seems that that is those also something that is increasingly difficult because there is so much information, and it can come from sometimes places that sound perfectly legitimate, and that can be rather difficult to say, well, all right, this source, who is this? Where does their funding come from? What is their political agenda if they have one? It's extremely difficult.
Right. And there are claims that are made that never take off. So there is this book that I don't encourage people to read, you can buy it on Amazon. It is about the president. The claim is made that the president, when he was a state senator, so when he was an adult, not a college kid, engaged in homosexual activity in the back of a limousine and sold cocaine. And this book is available. You can buy it. Go to Amazon and, you can find it on the internet. I'm not going to publicize it. But it's out there. And the author has a set of, let's call them, truth claims, assertions that he makes about this event, and it is backed up by what he considers, what he claims to be evidence. Now, it is a claim that has not been seen as plausible, as opposed to the birth certificate claim that many people did find plausible, the religion claim many people did find plausible, the gay sex claim is not something that even conservatives, most conservative, find as plausible, and so you hear it rather little.
Mm. Well, why is that? Is it just something about that we're just very uncomfortable with anything that has to do with sexuality, and we just rather not have anything to do with it, or that it just does it seem wildly out of character with what we think we know about the president?
Yes, it's out of character both about Obama personally, strong marriage, he's seen as even by his enemies as good family man, as having a good relationship with his wife. And it's also, there's probably an element of racism as well. The idea of a black man and engaging in gay sex is not, doesn't fit our prejudicial images, our stereotypic images. So this claim, this book, has gotten very, very little attention, even though it is perhaps no less credible than the birth certificate claim.
Mm. All right. Other callers here. And again, we're getting to our last 5-6 minutes, so we'll try to get as many callers as we can. So we'll go next to, Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I called earlier, and I have to object. You completely mischaracterized my assertion about the value of expert opinion as opposed to uninformed opinion. I did not suggest that the truth of the matter should be a matter of a public site that 95% this side, 95% that side, regardless of the value and the expertise of the opinion. My point was that expert opinion, the opinion of scientists in the field, has greater value than uninformed opinion. Thank you.
All right.
I can agree with that. The danger always is, I'm not suggesting that this caller was making that claim, but that we will look at a particular debate and say there are more people on one side than the other. But it is absolutely right that expertise matters, and that we should take that into account in judging any sort of public controversy.
All right. We'll do at least one more. Go to Belgium, and this would be line number 4. Hello.
Hello. During the whole conversation, you've defined rumors and stuff like this. Now, the question I've got is, can you tell me, is religion fact or rumor?
Religion is belief, right? So it stands a little bit apart from fact or rumor. Now, within any given religion, there's a proposed history, and some of that history is accepted by historians, and others rely on the faith of parishioners. And faith is very important. Belief is very important. And that's part of the process by which we come to define for ourselves what the meaning of our lives are.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that isn't, though, does rumor, can rumor have that same function? I mean, in the sense that what it is it's helping to, in situations where we are confused or frightened or conflicted, that these kinds of stories that we might label rumors help us to try to figure out what it is we really think.
Well, it makes us feel comfortable because those beliefs that we have, we can now justify those beliefs by virtue of the facts that rumor claims for itself. So that there was, in rumor, this attack on white people, black people, Hispanics, whoever. The rumor is it actually happened. And therefore, our belief becomes justified by this truth claim, this assertion that these things actually occurred.
Generally, do beliefs come first? Or is that not so easy to sort out?
Well, I mean, they go in both directions. Yeah. Rumors, to get legs, to be accepted, need to fit into a belief structure. So in that sense, you know, the belief comes first, but then the rumor, as it is spread, helps to expand, extend, make more confident the belief that people have.
All right. To another caller here. Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, you talk about claims that never take that take hold and shouldn't, but there are some that never take hold and probably should. One I'm thinking of, for example, the many Serbs didn't believe what some of their military atrocities that some of their military had committed in Bosnia until they saw pictures of it. And another one of much greater consequence to us, you know, it came through were the estimates of excess deaths in Iraq. So there were, you know, there were two studies published in The Lancet done by a group at Johns Hopkins, you know, both of whom should be reputable sources, but they ended up estimating the better part of 1 million excess deaths by about 2006. And that figure, even though the study appeared to be sound, that figure was hardly reported at all, and many people presented with it simply refused to believe it. I think on the understanding that, you know, we couldn't do anything that monstrous. We couldn't be engaged in such a terrible thing. And so they screened it out, even though the mechanisms behind it suggested that it was legitimate. I just want, you know, what
right.
How do you break through that sort of barrier that we can't be doing anything so terrible and therefore it isn't happening?
Well, the caller is right to, and this gets back to what I had said earlier in the hour, to talk about the politics of plausibility, that there are some things that are accurate, some things that happened that don't seem plausible to a large audience. And this seems to be a case in point. And so the challenge is, for the moment, accepting this as accurate, and I don't know the details of the study, but, you know, how do you get information to the public that stands in opposition to what they are primed to believe? And that's one of our challenges.
We have about 2 minutes or about a minute and a half. And let me just, I want to thank the callers, by the way, and say, as a way of finishing up, can you just talk for about a minute or so about this last element of the subtitle of the book is why it is that these things that we're talking about, why they matter?
Well, these matter because increasingly we are a global society, that what we believe about other nations and other people and immigration and terrorism and trade affects how our country will operate in this globalized world. We are no longer an island. We never were entirely an island, but it, you know, with each passing year, we become more and more integrated. And so the claims that I started talking about in terms of race now apply to these global rumors as well.
If you would like to read more on this subject, you might take a look at this book that I mentioned. The title is The Global Grapevine, Why Rumors of Terrorism, Immigration, and Trade Matter. It is published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Gary Allen Fine. He is a sociologist at Northwestern University. He's been here visiting the campus, interested in a lot of different things. So you might take a look at some of the other things that he's written. When is the chess book that you're working on, you think, going to be out?
My book on chess, it's going to be called Piecework. It should be published probably not next year, but hopefully the year after.
Right, and it's about the world of competitive chess playing.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And I'd be happy to come back sometime and talk to your callers about that.
All right. Well, again, our thanks to our guest, Gary Allen Fine. He's professor of sociology at Northwestern. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.